Hi, everyone. Thanks for inviting me. It's good to be back. So today I'm mostly going to be giving you an overview of the square kilometer array as a cosmology experiment. And in particular, I think one of the more exciting applications for using it as a cosmology experiment. So I think I'll just begin by talking about what the square kilometer array actually is. It's pretty well known in Europe, but people seem a bit more hazy on it in North America, at least. I don't know if that's the case in Canada. Canada's actually involved in this experiment in a significant way. But I'm just going to fill you in on some of the background. Then I'm going to talk about some of the more standard cosmology that we should hopefully be able to achieve with the square kilometer array using a technique called intensity mapping, which, again, many of you will have heard of. Then I'll move on to the physics that's happening on ultra-large scales in the universe. So this, I really mean the very largest observable scales. And I'm going to focus on late times, so redshifts 0 to 3 or so. Okay, and I'm going to try and convince you that there might be some interesting stuff happening there. So this might be a good place to start looking for new physics, modifications to general relativity, and that kind of thing. And as yet, it's relatively unprobed. So this is new territory, really. And then I'm going to talk some about the practicalities of actually measuring these ultra-large scales. And it looks tough. But we have this square kilometer array experiment. It has a substantial chunk of the funding needed to actually build the thing. And so we may as well try and use this for what I hope you'll agree is some pretty exciting cosmology. Okay, so let's just start off with some background on the SKA. So it was kind of born of a kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation in the late 80s, early 90s, the idea being, well, what sort of collecting area would you ideally need?
Yeah. The kilometer is RE or ER?
It's RE.
Okay, that's for Americans
to understand it well. Is that right? Yeah, we should rebrand. For now, just look at the first letters. Everyone will be okay. So the basic idea was, you know, what sort of collecting area would we need to really do a good job of detecting lots of neutral hydrogen?
Well, I suppose the whole kilometer thing, that's the problem. It should be a square mile array.
That would be fantastic. It would be huge. But right. No, I mean, as you'll see very shortly, it's hard enough to build a square kilometer in collecting area. I mean, we're not even actually doing the square kilometer yet. It turns out you need about a square kilometer to do the kind of interesting neutral hydrogen detection science that you might have imagined in 1991. Times have changed slightly, the models of the H1 emission have changed slightly, but a square kilometer is still a very nice thing to aim at. So you can just see here from this abstract, this kind of position paper by Peter Wilkinson at the time, it's going to be something like 14 times larger than the Arecibo dish in terms of collecting area. So it's going to be the most sensitive radio telescope ever built. That's the kind of bottom line.
What's the pattern on?
Oh, sorry. So it turns out that this is just an artist's impression, right? But you want to position the dishes so that the various baselines cover a whole range of different baseline lengths. So if you had it in a regular grid, you'd vastly prefer the intergrid spacing. And you don't want that, because for an interferometer, you're sensitive to scales that go as one over the baseline length, essentially. So you want something like a logarithmic spiral or something like that, something that very smoothly covers all of the possible different baseline spacings, which is why it looks like just a random mess. People still argue about what the best layout of this thing is.
Is the layout actually predefined? I know that in the early days of radio astronomy, people spent an inordinate amount of time figuring out how to make sure there are absolutely no integrated baselines and all of that. And then I thought once you got to this number of dishes, you could just drop sand on the table. That would be as good as any other.
No, it's not quite like that, because so with the square kilometer array, you have a bunch of different science cases. For some things, you want, like, high sensitivity at very high angular resolution. So you want lots of really long baselines, because remember, it goes as the inverse of the baseline length. For the stuff I'm going to be talking about, we care about really large scales. And so actually, you'd want all of these dishes kind of packed into the center to get the maximum sensitivity on those large scales. So there are all these trade-offs involved. And so there's an entire working group inside the SK trying to balance these various competing interests. And it gets nasty sometimes, and people argue about this, and they're still arguing, and they'll continue to argue until the thing's actually built, probably long after that as well. So, but yeah, it's an interesting problem, though, optimizing this. So, okay, so just to give you a very quick picture of where this is on an international footing, in blue are the countries who are involved in this. You see these are the two host countries here. This is Australia and South Africa. The array is actually split up into three components. I'll tell you about those in the next slide. And they're split between South Africa and Australia, not for any particularly good scientific reason, but you know, politics intervenes when there's funding money going on. So that's the reason for that. But you see that there are quite a few European countries, that the head office is in the UK. You see Canada's involved. There's a bit of a question mark over Germany right now. Their government pulled out, but their kind of scientific oversight bodies didn't pull out. They're quite annoyed, so that's still up in the air a bit. But yeah, so this is the current picture, and there are several countries that are supposed to be thinking about joining and providing some funding. So you'll see a very notable omission here, the US. There are various reasons for that. We can go into that later if people are at all interested in the politics. Okay.
How much money are we talking about?
So for phase one of this array, which is actually going to be this and two things that look kind of similar to this, we're talking about something like, for the baseline design, 850 million euros, I think is the current estimate. That's probably wrong. And they've just cost kept it at something more like 650 million euros. So they want to kind of freeze costs and go ahead and build this. So there needs to be a cost-cutting exercise applied, which will probably mean either losing one of these three arrays in phase one, which isn't the full thing, so they could be added later, or each of these will need to be trimmed by about a third. And that's expected to happen in the middle of next year. I have no idea what the outcome will be. I kind of hope they just get rid of one of these arrays, maybe, because we have two of them. But you can't guarantee what the logic will be behind this decision. So there are already very major funding commitments to this. So it looks like it probably will go ahead. There's probably not so much risk as far as that's concerned. But in what form it goes ahead is a bit of a question mark as well. Okay, so again, just to sort of briefly show you through these, you have this low-frequency array. It just looks like a load of coat-hangers, wire coat-hangers stuck in a field, essentially. This is everything from about 350 megahertz downwards, so maybe down to 90 megahertz or something like that. So for neutral hydrogen, redshifted neutral hydrogen, that corresponds to redshifts of 3 upwards. So really the cosmology that we're going to be able to do with this low-frequency array is epoch of reionization type stuff. So I'm not going to talk so much about that today. I'm going to focus on late times. There's lots of stuff out there on the EOR science case, though, and it's really cool stuff. For phase two, which is kind of the final beast, the thing that should have 10 times the sensitivity of this initial phase, these two things in combination, there's this idea of a mid-frequency aperture array. I won't talk much about that. You know, we can chat afterwards if you like. And then the thing I'm really going to focus on here is these mid-frequency dish arrays. So there are two of these planned. One is called SK1-MID, which stands for mid-frequency array. That's going to be based in South Africa. And there's also going to be one called SK1-SUR, which stands for survey. And that's the one based in Australia. And they have very, very similar capabilities for all of the science that I'm going to be talking about. So they're not quite interchangeable, but it's close. Okay. So again, just to reiterate, this isn't just some pipe dream that's still on kind of the design paper. It has this phase design where it's already effectively in construction. You have all of these Pathfinder arrays, which are, some of them are even in the ground now. These are real photos. This is the Cat-7 array in the Karoo Desert in South Africa. This is ASCAP. This is the Pathfinder for the survey array. I should say this is one of the pathfinders for the mid-array, and then they're currently building this Meerkat array, which is an upgrade to this, essentially. These dishes, the ones that are actually in the ground now, will actually form part of the final phase one array. So we already have a big chunk of this instrument. It's just we need to triple it, quadruple it in size to actually meet these phase one design specifications. And these things are already producing science. So I think Cat7 had its first Nature paper a couple of months ago or something. So, you know, this is happening and this is real. And the time frames are very soon. So this is constructed. This should probably be due in about 2017. And the full phase one is due for something like 2020. So soon. So what do we want to use all of this stuff for? Yeah.
So how does this compare to Chime?
So that's a really good question. I'll talk about Chime a little bit later. The main difference, I guess, and I'm sure Whaley can sort of fill in some of the details, is that the SKA is really a general purpose instrument. The idea is to have this as a facility built for the entire radio astronomy community that should hang around in some form or another for about 70 years.
70
years. Yeah. And I don't know what the final idea will be, but you should be able to do things like apply for time on it to observe specific objects, much like you can do with the Hubble Space Telescope, but also to do large surveys of the type I'm going to be talking about as well. So it's this kind of very big general purpose instrument.
Is there a collecting area?
I don't know what the effective collecting area of Chime is.
But it's in this
mid-half. Okay. So, yeah. So phase one is going to have something like four times the collecting area of that, just raw collecting area.
Because Chime has 100 times the survey speed of Meerkat, so mm-hmm. it's not obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
So the area is as 100 times faster, you say?
Well, then Meerkat, however, SKA1 is has more collecting area mm-hmm. and has a lower survey speed than Chime, but that's not a fair comparison mm-hmm. because, as Phil is saying, this is an imaging experiment. Chime is purely spectroscopic.
Pretty
pictures
of
jets far away,
China's
not
going to
do it for you.
Sure, right.
Yep.
It's a
difference in angular resolution.
Exactly.
But for cosmology, they're doing the same thing? Was that
right? They're doing similar things, right? So what I'm going to show you later is that SKA is not the ideal telescope to do a lot of the intensity mapping stuff that we want to do with it. Chime is purpose-built for that sort of thing. So Chime has the upper hand in that sense, but the SK has other features that mean that we might actually be able to get an effective higher sensitivity. So it will depend a lot on things, solving various systematic issues and stuff like that. So we'll go into that in much more detail a bit later.
And there's no overlap in Sky.
But there's no overlap.
Yeah.
Chime cannot see south of the equator, and well, it could see a little bit north. But it's,
yeah, but the overlap is going to be tiny. Which is a good thing, really. So.
That's what I was asking, whether you could like make a fuller sky map combining this, but I guess it depends.
You kind of could, but I'm going to talk about this again in a little bit as well. The idea is to use the SK in a kind of different mode to the way Chime is being used, which means you'll be sensitive to different modes, essentially, which, I mean, you could stitch the maps together, but there'd be some interesting filtering that you'd need to do. So, yep, this is the thing we're after. This is the thing we're trying to hunt down, neutral hydrogen. The idea being that you just have a neutral hydrogen atom. These are really ubiquitous in the universe. And there's a very, very, very forbidden spin-flip transition, which means that something like once per 10 million years, it emits a radio photon at this very precisely measured frequency. Okay, and this turns out to be at about 21 centimeters in wavelength. And this is fantastic. Radio astronomers have been using this for years to do things like measure the rotation curve of our own galaxy. But we want to extend these detections to very high redshift. And that's hard to do because, you know, even though this H1 is everywhere in the universe, it's still a relatively weak signal. So it's only now becoming possible to do these large surveys with very modern, highly sensitive radio telescopes. People have detected H1 cosmologically. So for example, with the Green Bank Telescope, Whaley was involved in this. But this is really just the start of a much bigger program. Okay. And so if you have something that's everywhere in the universe and you can measure its emission, well, this means we can use it as a probe of large-scale structure. So you can think of this as very similar to doing something like a galaxy survey. So this H1 will mostly be hosted inside very dense clouds, damp Lyman alpha systems inside galaxies. And so it's effectively a tracer of the galaxy distribution, which is a biased tracer of the cold dark matter distribution. So all of your intuition from various other large-scale structure experiments, most of it will apply here. So this is really what we're doing with H1 surveys. Okay. And of course, large-scale structure observables are sort of tipped to enable us to answer some of these really big questions we have in cosmology. So I mean, take your pick, but this involves things like figuring out, you know, is dark energy just a cosmological constant, or is there some time evolution? If so, what is the equation of state? That tells a lot about the specific model you have of dark energy. A very important one is we're now in a position to be able to test general relativity on cosmological scales. Most precision tests of general relativity are on solar system scales, essentially, and they're very tightly constraining. GR passes all of the tests. But on cosmological scales, there are reasons to believe that things could break down. And so being able to pin down whatever the theory of gravity is in this regime would be a fantastic test of fundamental physics. Also, you can do things with trying to probe the initial conditions of the universe. So this is mostly things like various tests of inflation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this, but I'm mostly going to be talking about things like probing non-Gaussianity, for example, and things like that. Okay, so how do we access this information? Well, the primary way of accessing it is by measuring this thing, which is that just a two-point function of cosmological matter density perturbations, the matter power spectrum. You see it has this very characteristic shape in Fourier space, which is, say, flat Fourier space. So I think what I'll point out here is these are the things we mostly go for these days, the baryon acoustic oscillations, these wiggles in the matter power spectrum. And these have been left there by acoustic oscillations in the early universe when baryons and photons were coupled together. Okay? And what they effectively do is define a kind of standard ruler, a preferred physical scale that we can then measure from galaxy surveys and other things like that, and use that to accurately measure distances. And if you can measure distances, you can measure things like the expansion rate, and you can measure the geometry of the universe, and that lets you pin down things like what the dark energy density is at a given redshift, what the curvature of the universe is, and things like that. So people have been doing that for a while now, and it's been very successful. You also have some complications. So at smaller scales, so smaller scales corresponds to higher k, of course. You have nonlinear effects due to just nonlinear gravitational collapse, but also astrophysical effects. You have things like baryon feedback type effects, which means this regime is very messy and complicated. I don't think anyone truly understands it yet. People apply simulations. They sometimes get divergent results. This is tough stuff down here. And so the point I'm just trying to make is, I mean, there's still a lot of information about cosmology in this regime, but it's tough to model, and so you can never be exactly sure that you're recovering true cosmological information rather than just seeing biases due to unmodeled effects or things like that. And that creeps into the baryon acoustic oscillation measurements as well. So how can we measure this? With the SKA, at least. So the SKA will be able to do a galaxy redshift survey. I said individual galaxies are host to H1. H1 emits with a very specific rest frame frequency. And so if we just measure the redshift of this 21 centimeter line and detect these galaxies, we have just what's essentially a traditional galaxy redshift survey. So just to give you some picture for how an SK phase one galaxy redshift survey would compare to current optical and near-infrared surveys, you see something like BOSS, which is mostly complete. It may even already be complete now. I'm not sure. You get something like 1.5 million galaxies out of a redshift of about 0.7 over something like 10,000 square degrees. phase one of the SKA, which should have a first survey completed by something like 2022, if everything goes to plan. We'll get, you know, quite a few more galaxies, but they're heavily biased towards lower redshifts. And you only have the sensitivity to do something like a 5,000 square degree survey in, say, a couple of years. And when all of that is folded in, you find that actually an SKA1 H1 galaxy redshift survey would perform worse than VOS. So we're not really gaining much by doing this. I mean, you can gain some interesting insights into galaxy evolution through the way H1 evolves over that redshift range, but in terms of just raw cosmology, we're not really adding much to the current picture, which is a bit of a shame, but remember, this is just phase one. This is just the first iteration. If you compare this with Euclid, which should be complete a few years later, you see there's absolutely no competition. But then if we consider the full SKA, it's so sensitive we're looking at something like a billion galaxies. This really is going to be the biggest galaxy redshift survey ever performed, and out to a very substantial redshift. Probably these Euclid numbers will be revised soon, by the way. The numbers aren't public yet, but this upper redshift is going to probably fall to something like redshift 1.8. But either way, I mean, we're talking about a billion galaxies here. So that's something to look forward to. But, you know, I'm going to be pretty old by 2027, I figure. So I'd like something a bit sooner. So let's talk about another technique we can use instead of galaxy redshift survey. So this is called intensity mapping. The idea being, if you detect individual galaxies, you spend a lot of time staring at those individual galaxies to make sure they're not just random noise fluctuations. You want to detect them with something like at least a 10 sigma significant above the background noise. And that means you waste lots and lots of photons, right? Also, you know, you're trying to measure the redshift of these things at the same time, right? You're not just trying to see where they are on the sky. You also want to know where they are in redshift space. And so to do that, you also need very high sensitivity. So just going back to this expression, this tells you, this is just a simple equation that governs essentially what the noise RMS is of a radio telescope. And you see it's 1/√ of this delta nu, that's the channel bandwidth. So if you want high spectral resolution, if you make this small, you see you make your noise larger. And so you need to integrate down. You need a much longer observing time. Okay. So the point being that spectroscopic surveys take a long time. We're only interested in the large scales here. We only really care about stuff around the BAO scales and higher. So why don't we just concentrate on those scales rather than spending all of our time measuring these tiny little galaxies that are mere tens of kiloparsecs across rather than hundreds of megaparsecs across? We don't have to do that. We can map out the integrated emission from many, many galaxies just by making low resolution observations. So imagine you have a galaxy field here, all these individual galaxies at various redshift slices, okay? If you do a galaxy redshift survey, you see all of these individually, and then you can process this data in some way that allows you to access the large scale information. So you can see here, there's kind of a void region. That's large scale information, right? You don't have to do that. You can just kind of blur your eyes a bit, use low resolution observations, and still capture the large scale information. So see here that the void is still represented. You just don't get the small scales. They're all kind of integrated together now. And you still see this as a very high resolution sort of function of redshift. Okay, and this is good because it means you are using the sensitivity of your radio telescope better. You're not wasting time measuring the super small scales. And of course that means you're not doing any thresholding or something like that. You don't throw away galaxies that are only detected with 9 sigma significance. You keep everything. You know, you're seeing galaxies that you would never say were actually detected at all. It's all integrated together. This is much more similar to what we do with the CMB.
So does most of the demand-side information come from galaxies or from intergalactic?
As far as I'm aware, so at late times, you've got to remember there's this ionizing UV background, right? Which means that neutral hydrogen is just sitting there. will get ionized very quickly. Pretty much anything after reionization, I guess. But I'm a bit murky on stuff like that. But
see
redshift.
Alpha first, right? At this redshift 3, I think. So there is some.
Yeah,
so much
sure.
Less at redshift below 1, but there is.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. But I mean, as far as I'm aware, at least, most of this you should find in these very dense, damp Lyman alpha systems, which self-shield themselves. So they're so dense that UV photons don't penetrate very far into this blob of gas, and so most of it remains neutral. And of course, the cloud itself is actually transparent to radio emission, and so the emission just escapes.
I mean, yeah, but alpha has a neutral fraction of 10^-7, whereas the gamma-ions in the disks account for about 1%, the type of magnitude, more neutral stuff.
There's much bigger volume in the galactic. Isn't the idea that you see like most of cosmic missing barriers in Lyman alpha far as they shift up, I don't know, 2 or 3 or something like that?
That's right, but that's because you take the neutral fraction multiplied by the ionization fraction, you multiply by 10^7
right.
to get all the unity in Bale.
You infer more of the
right. You don't infer
right. directly.
Right, so fine, but I mean, okay, I see. So you're saying that there's very little, but you can see. But so there's much more in the galaxies.
Yeah, by like 5 orders of magnitude, more neutral gas in galaxies than there is in the Lyman alpha forest, integrated with the universe.
Okay, that's neat. So 5 orders of magnitude isn't to be sniffed at. So, and of course here, because you're detecting an emission line, you get the redshifts for free. So whatever the frequency is that you detect this emission at, that's just the redshift. Of course, in redshift space, there are going to be peculiar velocities and stuff like that to contend with. So I'll talk about that a little bit in a second. So just to give you a picture, I've shown you what intensity mapping looks like in angular space. It's just it's a low-resolution map of the galaxy distribution. This is just a kind of illustration of what it looks like in frequency space. So you see, you kind of have this mean H1 signal. Just think of this as kind of being like your background H1 signal. That's just some relatively smooth function of redshift. Now, imagine if you just had an individual galaxy, an individual density fluctuation on top of that. Well, you just see a small spike at a given frequency, which corresponds to a given redshift, right, wherever this galaxy is. Ditto for an underdensity, you'd see less H1 emission in a void region. You add up all of those over and underdensities, you get something more similar to this. Again, this is very stylized. I've put these very small scale fluctuations on here just to represent, you know, what's going on at small scales in the galaxy distribution. But you also get these large scale modes as well, because you're seeing the full dense matter perturbation distribution. Okay. Add to this noise, depending on the sensitivity of your telescope, this will either be, I mean, hopefully comparable or smaller to this signal. Otherwise, you're not going to detect it, or it might be much larger, in which case you're not going to detect it, apart from maybe on very large scales when you Fourier transform and it's all integrated together. Then you have this. This is a big problem, because this foreground emission, we're talking about things like synchrotron emission from our own galaxy, also things like point sources, just all sorts of other stuff going on out there in the universe, is something like 5 orders of magnitude larger than just the H1 fluctuations. It's a really huge foreground. There have been a lot of studies on this. It looks like it should be tractable in relatively ideal cases. Foreground subtraction algorithms are good enough to deal with this. But there are a bunch of messy instrumental effects that might cause problems. So I'll talk about those later. So the first step in actually using H1 intensity mapping as a kind of practical cosmological probe is to try and detect the baryonic acoustic oscillations. Like I said earlier, these really give you a distance scale. They're a nice, clean observable from large-scale structure in principle. This hasn't been done yet. So, I mean, the actual cosmological signal has been detected. Think of this as maybe like a detection of band power over the power spectrum. No one's actually detected the baryonic acoustic oscillations yet. This is what forthcoming experiments like CHIME, which again many of you have heard about. This is based in Canada.
So that detection is a cross correlation.
There are as far as I'm aware, there are two detections. One's GBT cross wiggles, which is a detection in cross correlation. But there's also an auto correlation detection.
We would like to call it auto correlation detection. It depends a bit on the definition of auto correlation.
Yes. But if you don't use other things, then it's not the first. If you don't use other surveys, then
no, it's not auto correlation. It's not. I would call it a detection. The only question is, so you take a map, you subtract what you think is foregone, you have something left. To show that that thing is real, you have to have a cross correlation, even though without it, it's still, you having cross correlation after the fact, you know that it's dominated by a real Twitter finger structure. Mm-hmm. But how would you have known that if you hadn't had a template? So in hindsight, it's an autocorrelation.
Okay, so it's like use the external templates to paint it in some sense? Is that
no.
Just to prove that it's
just to prove that. Otherwise, you never convince anybody it's real.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Autocorrelation confirmed with a cross correlation.
So this makes my point perfectly. This is still early days. This is messy stuff. Lots of people are working very hard on this, but the magical BAO detection hasn't happened just yet. Chime should certainly have the sensitivity to detect it. The sensitivity isn't, in some sense, the issue. The issue is dealing with systematic effects and stuff like that. So kind of watch this space. I also want to highlight another experiment that's currently on the drawing board, which is called Bingo. This is mostly based in the UK, but also has involvement from Brazil and Uruguay. They're planning to build it in a kind of quarry in Uruguay, and this uses a different technology to Chime. This uses autocorrelation. This is an interferometric experiment. I'm going to talk about that very shortly.
What year does Chime hope to detect the BAO?
The official statement is that it's supposed to finish construction next year, start taking data the year after, it's 2016, 2 year timescale, so the official timescale is about 2018, but that's kind of thing, it's guaranteed to not happen before that.
So really, I think it's probably going to be Chime or something very similar to Chime that does get the first BAO detection. It probably won't be the SKA. It's a few years beyond that. It would be scary if Chime or something similar didn't see the BAO. It'd be scary for this SKA stuff that I'm talking about, at least. That means it's a much harder problem, and we're probably going to struggle a lot. So it's kind of fingers crossed stuff, but you know, let's see.
So what are those five floating things in the image on the right?
Oh, these are actually it's not a particularly good visualization. These are feed horns. These are the actual detectors. So the light kind of comes in. I think the idea is to come in like this, and then bounce this way. Or no, maybe it's like this.
So they're like floating in the air.
Yeah, they wouldn't actually be floating in the air. That would be amazing. But they'd be attached to some kind of rig. So another thing I should point out is that this thing is being effectively built in a rainforest. It's extremely humid there. And these feed horns, given the design of this thing, need to be something like 4 meters long. So if you can just imagine 4 meters through there or something, these things are huge. It's really a fantastically mad design that might just work. So, but yeah, they'll be attached to something, don't worry.
They could be drones, right?
Yeah. I'd love to see you do the pointing calibration for that, but it's the future, so maybe. So this is just to give you a kind of picture of what you should be able to do with something like a large intensity mapping survey for baryon acoustic oscillations on phase one of the SKA. So the yellow bar, mostly just ignore it. This is the H1 galaxy survey. And I already mentioned that that's kind of worse than BOSS. I'm adding in the BOSS and Planck constraints here, just to give a more realistic picture of the actual constraints on these parameters. Of course, there's just W0WA, the standard dark energy equation of state parameters. And the thing to take away from this is that Euclid, this kind of gray ellipse, isn't that much smaller than the intensity mapping ellipse. So even already a few years before Euclid, you're getting down to, you know, twiddles, the same order of magnitude in the dark energy figure of merit with something like a H1 intensity mapping survey. So, you know, this is pretty good stuff for, you know, considering it's not really been done before. You have to think, well, maybe we're being optimistic here. I mean, we're certainly being optimistic. These are just Fisher forecasts anyway. But, you know, on paper, it's, you can do some good large-scale structure science with it, just the standard stuff that people are already doing. So, you know, it's interesting from that perspective already. And, of course, this is just SKA2, the full SKA, this billion galaxy survey I talked about, which, I mean, just blows everything else out of the water.
Question, this is just for BAO or is this?
Yeah, this is just BAO plus these, plus like a CMB
so
prior.
So how use the full power spectrum?
So, I mean, I have those plots I can show you later if you want, but
I mean,
everything shrinks. I mean, in linear dimensions, it's less than a factor of 2,
okay.
I'd say. But actually what does seem to happen there is, and again, this is contingent on systematic effects, etc. The H1, so it does get closer to the Euclid contours.
So is there any justification for just using VAO and not the full power spectrum?
Yes, it's cleaner. Using the full broadband shape of the power spectrum, that's fine. That's ideally what you'd do. But you need a really good model of things like whether your bias is scale dependent. There are lots of other kind of broadband effects that could really screw up that measurement. With the BAO, it's just a feature. And if you see a feature, you're just measuring the location of this feature, and that's a very robust observable, which is why people concentrate on it so much. I agree, in the future, use the whole data, but it's tough.
I think in the last boss plots that I saw, the power spectrum totally disagreed on the scales larger than the peak of the power spectrum. So since the peak itself is one of the shape things that is giving you your information, data,
yeah, but I mean,
don't have the same peak due to systematics.
If the systematics affect the peak, there is nothing that it doesn't affect the BAO either. It might be smaller.
In principle, true, but it's probably less sensitive.
And the BAO are much better sampled. So I'll actually show a plot from these BOSS results later. The actual peak of the power spectrum, the matter radiation equality peak, isn't so well sampled. You're getting pretty close to the kind of volume limits of your survey, so there are lots of messy effects there as well.
Too much. I mean, there are not many modes at the peak, but
no.
Most of the signal I imagine comes from the smaller scales.
Oh, definitely.
So that would be the big problem. Is the
Exactly. So people have shown that nonlinear effects should only affect, like, shift the BAO scale by certainly the sub-percent level, something like 0.1, 0.2%. That seems to be the accepted value. So it's very robust. For the broadband spectrum, I don't know the number, but it will certainly be larger. But definitely in the future, the hope is our models are good enough that we can do this. Okay. And I'll just whiz through a few forecast plots. They're really just to show you that you can do interesting, relatively standard cosmology with this sort of thing. So this is just the gamma. This is the growth index, just a simple parameterization of growth. You have omega m to the gamma is the linear growth rate. And you can play with gamma, and that should, in some sense, give you a handle on modifications to general relativity. And you see, you kind of have some broadly complementary behavior here between the Euclid and an SK1 survey with intensity mapping. So ideally, you combine the two and get tighter constraints on gamma. I'm not going to go into this too much. Also, these are just some very preliminary results on neutrinos. This is mostly looking at the smaller scales, really. And again, you can do pretty well. So especially the full SKA should do the best, of course. It just has so many galaxies. That's a given. But again, you're kind of in the same ballpark with this intensity mapping survey. So, you know, it can do all of this regular large-scale structure science. Where does an intensity mapping survey really win out, though? Because With a galaxy survey, you're getting both the small scales and the large scales. You're keeping more information. So even though it's slower, even though it's less efficient in some sense, people are already building galaxy surveys that will do surveys over substantial redshift ranges, over substantial fractions of the sky. So where can intensity mapping really beat out those things? I mean, if we already have Euclid or DESI or something like that, what do you really add just by being able to do something similar but missing some information and being able to do it faster? Well, you don't gain that much initially. But where intensity mapping can really win out is in survey volume, just raw survey volume. So you can see here that this is just the co-moving effective survey, the co-moving physical survey volume, if that makes sense. I don't mean the effective volume. I'm not saying that this is all being probed to a sample variance level, but it's the actual volume that you're probing. See, BOSS is way down here. This also shows the redshift range. Something like WFIRST is going to...
Is this effective volume or is it not effective volume?
So it's the co-moving volume of the physical region of space that you're going to survey. It's not the effect. It's not weighted in any way by the noise.
But that would be the one that matters for...
Yeah, exactly.
You can go see very poorly to very high redshift, but if you're not doing
this, this is better than that. The thing is, so this is kind of... You can think of this as like a limiting... So if you could do these various surveys forever, then you'd eventually converge on this actual volume. That's not so much the case for the galaxy surveys. You're kind of limited by the luminosity function and stuff like that of your galaxies. But for these things, I mean, all the time I'm observing here a 10,000-hour survey, which is a little under 2 years on Sky. I mean, I've just told you that the SKA will be a facility that's supposed to live for something like 70 years. Imagine if you just kept going, and just kept going, kept going, and kept going, and you could solve all of these systematics. Then you converge on these actual things. So actually, the forecasts sort of bear this out. I mean, you're if you're interested in these ultra-large scales that I'm going to talk about next, you already have pretty good signal-to-noise in that regime anyway. So this gives you a good handle on this.
This is co-moving volume, but out to a distance of redshift of, let's say, 3, you get a co-moving distance of maybe 4 gigaparsecs. 4 cubed to 64 times 3 is 192, is the volume of the universe of the redshift 3. Why does this look like it's twice the volume of the Hubble radius to redshift 3 in SK1?
I don't know.
What is the distance to redshift 3?
About 4 gigaparsecs, so if you take 4
times pi r cubed,
is 4 gigaparsecs to redshift
3?
Is that
happening? Or
a bit less?
Yeah.
It's 6
gigaparsecs
to redshift 6.
But if you do the dV by dz integral, this is what you get. So maybe... I mean, let's look at that afterwards. But yeah. Anyway, in some units, this is the volume, at least. So... the point being that, okay, even with something like this huge monster SK2 survey, this galaxy survey, it's still, you know, only just over a half what you can do with an intensity mapping survey. Yep.
Do you know where there's various other things proposed? I think it's Foremost and on the BL, what is it? What's Foremost on? Reed Vista, I think. And something else called Weave. I mean, there's a couple of other things that have been proposed.
Yeah, so Weave is out here. They're probably not going to do a cosmological survey, it turns out. They don't really have the sensitivity. But it would be in a kind of similar ballpark to HetDex. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about Foremost.
Okay, I can't say I didn't use H yet, so this was an H of about 65. You push the H all the way down to maximize your volume. And because of the whole sky, you get close to 700. But that's where you're pushing.
Okay. I haven't. I've just kind of taken the Planck cosmology and done this dV by dz integral. So I mean, maybe we're talking about slightly different things. So I mean, let's figure this out after because it is important. But yeah, I was pretty sure this was co-moving. But okay. So intensity mapping surveys win on volume. what can you do with that? Oh, well, you can just sample more modes of your BAO or something. That's probably not going to help so much, right? Because something like Euclid has access to these smaller scales, you have many more modes there, and so it's still going to effectively win out on things like the dark energy equation of state and stuff like that. So the idea is you can maybe go for stuff that something like at least BOSS, but maybe even Euclid can't touch. And that's these ultra large scales. So, and by this, I'm just arbitrarily defining these as being beyond this matter radiation equality B. So anything below about K of 10 to the minus 2 inverse megaparsecs. Okay, well, why would you want to do that? There are a few possible reasons. It's not really been probed yet. Okay, so a particularly interesting one is that the Newtonian approximation breaks down. So most current analyses of large-scale structure rely on what's essentially a Newtonian analysis, and so do most n-body simulations, right? We're just assuming that everything is Newtonian. We're doing everything in just actually like Fourier space. And that's been fine so far. But at these ultra-large scales, you start getting these wide-angle effects and these relativistic effects that really do start to matter. So you can't just stick with Newtonian anymore. You really need to care about things like the fact that you're observing down a light cone. You're not just observing a chunk of real space somewhere. You're really stuck looking down a past light cone. Also, at these scales, you're very far away from these nonlinear effects in principle. I mean, whether any nonlinear effects get folded into your analysis is going to depend in some sense on what your instrument looks like, but probably you're looking at such extremely linear scales that, you know, this would just be very simple linear cosmological perturbation theory type regimes that you're probing. And that can be interesting as well. There's also this connection to primordial physics. So because causal processes haven't really had much time to operate on these scales, you still have various things like signatures of inflation that can be kind of left over there. I'm going to make this a bit more concrete shortly. And also, of course, this is an as yet unprobed regime, so maybe there'll be some surprises, right? So this is just a really big potato. So I'm hoping that, you know, maybe ultra-large scales can give us our own really big unexpected potato in terms of maybe some unexpected signature of modifications to GR. There might be some weird inflationary relic there. I mean, we can't even imagine. Everyone will have different priors on the odds of any of that happening, but it often happens that going to new regimes can give us some surprises.
But don't you see the scales already in CMB?
Excellent. I'm going to move on to that in a couple of slides. So just to give you a very brief survey of what I mean by things like the Newtonian approximation breaking down. You get all these kind of extra effects due to lensing. Lensing becomes non-negligible. The redshift space distortions become much more important. So just to show you that this is the expression to linear order in perturbations. This is just the observed gauge invariant density fluctuation for, say, a galaxy survey. In the Newtonian approximation, you're essentially just seeing this term, just some effective density fluctuation term, plus a redshift space distortion term, maybe some small amount of lensing, stuff like that. But actually, when you do the full thing, you get all of these extra contributions, many of which are familiar from when we look at the CMB. So for example, you can see there's an ISW term. You also get a Doppler term, this thing, just a kind of generic Sachs-Wolfe term. All of these are in there. Most of them are quite small, but you see that some of these are integrated along the line of sight. They add up, and so they become non-negligible on these ultra-large scales. So this is just a kind of picture trying to show this a little bit. Of course, you can't really separate out these contributions so easily, and a lot of what you see depends on, for example, whether you have a narrow or wide redshift bin. So this is familiar to people who are familiar with lensing type studies, and also what redshift you're looking at. So this is what the different lines are that you're seeing. But you see, for something like the redshift space distortions at low L, so a small spherical harmonic, like large angular scales. You see, this is like a factor of two correction in some cases at these very low out, the redshift space distortions. You can also see like a nice few percent correction just due to velocity type terms. Of course, lensing can be quite large in some regimes as well. And you know, you also have maybe percent level corrections due to the potentials on large scales. Again, very familiar stuff from the CMB, but it's different in this regime. The perturbations have grown, certainly. There's extra physics in there, and that could be interesting. Another thing that might be kind of cute is that you can see causally disconnected regions at late times. So again, in the CMB, we're seeing lots of roughly degree scale causally disconnected patches. They were only connected to each other pre-inflation, right? So this is due to what the horizon size was at that time. Well, here we should actually be able to start probing the comoving horizon size, probably at relatively high redshift, certainly above redshift 1.5 or so. But these surveys are big enough to start seeing disconnected regions. That might be interesting for things like testing homogeneity, the spatial variations of fundamental constants, that sort of thing. There are these models out there. It's not particularly mainstream stuff, but you know, it at least gives us the possibility of looking at this stuff. And also a particularly interesting one might be looking at modifications to the growth of structure. So I'm talking about things like the linear growth rate, F, which is just a logarithmic derivative with respect to the scale factor of the orbital density fluctuation. This is a key observable in studies looking for modifications to gravity. And it turns out many modified gravity theories see quite substantial scale dependence being introduced into this growth rate at these very large scales. They almost always go as 1 over k squared. So if you have something like a Horndesky scalar field theory, you see that there's a very generic and fixed form for what this scale dependence can look like. This is where it enters, at these super large scales. So this might actually be a nice clean way of looking for modifications to GR. So there are these reasons for looking at these scales. Also, another one that's been relatively well studied is non-Gaussianity. So in the presence of primordial local type non-Gaussianity, you get this extra scale dependent bias on these large scales. This also goes as 1 over k squared. And so people have been working on figuring out ways of trying to detect this as well. If you have these large scales, you can probe further and further. So if you have these large volumes, you can probe further and further into this regime, and so you can really start to kind of see where this diverges from it. It's just purely Gaussian prediction. And the various forecasts that exist out there suggest that we should be able to get sigma FNL CMB equivalent of certainly less than 1. Again, if you can measure this stuff. So, existing constraints. There are definitely existing constraints from the CMB, but what we're really doing here is talking about a different regime. So the CMB is obviously at early times. We know that everything there is superlinear anyway, and it's effectively just matter and radiation dominated. A lot of the things I've just talked about are more... It's more important that we have some non-negligible fraction of dark energy. So, for example, you might expect things like general relativistic corrections to only matter, modified gravity corrections to GR to only matter at late times. I mean, obviously, most people are constructing models to cause these modifications at late times. So, I mean, you just can't probe it in the same.
Talking about inflationary relics, because presumably they would be around the time
of CMB. Sure. But, I mean, what you've also got to remember is, I mean, with this... So with the CMB, we're just seeing one last scattering surface, right? With this other stuff, we're seeing a different volume of the universe. So if these inflationary relics are in some sense localized and rare, and we don't see them at the last scattering surface, well, we can at least try and look for them in a different part of space. Again, I agree, it's a bit of a long shot with those ones, but at least in principle, we can try and look for them. Okay. So the point here is that ultra-large scales have been measured already, but in a different regime. They've been measured at very high redshift, where dark energy or possible modifications to gravity just aren't important yet. And that's why it's important to look at this late time regime instead. So again, just to give you some picture of what's already been done, this is the raw power spectrum constraint from BOSS, DR11. I think they can access scales a little bit larger than here, but there are issues with that. Because you're getting very, I mean, you know, they don't have a very homogeneous slice of functions.
There's already inconsistency, right? This is, I've been added one
for two. No, I think this is the difference between a north and south patch, or that there are two different patches. And
the systematics that I mentioned. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So you see that they're a bit different. And I don't think you can really count this as a detection of the matter radiation equality peak yet.
Does that error include sample variance or not?
I'm not sure.
I would be surprised if it didn't.
Yeah, I'm guessing not.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think you have the volume. Yeah, it's probably not. But anyway, so again, the point here is that, you know, we're on the way to actually being able to get into this, what I'm calling ultra-large scale regime, but we're not there yet. We're close. And yeah, there are issues. So this is why this stuff is motivated. And again, just to point out the difference between BOSS down here, order sort of 10 cubic gigaparsecs in some units, and this, which I argue is something like 70 times larger in volume. You see, you're going to measure many more modes. So these guys, the next 10 years, are going to make ultra-large-scale late-time cosmology actually possible. So how can we actually access these scales with the square kilometer array? So we're just going to assume a fiducial 25,000 square degree SKA survey, and the dishes are something like 15 meters across. So you can imagine using your array of dishes in two different modes. Can either cross-correlate all the dishes together in an interferometer mode, which is this blue curve here, or you can imagine using them all separately as single dishes in what we call an autocorrelation mode, which is much more similar to what people tend to do with the CMB, with the CMB experiments. And you're sensitive to different but complementary angular scales. So an interferometer can only see scales effectively as large as the shortest baseline and as small as the longest baseline. And so that's what gives you this blue region here. And then autocorrelation can see any scales between the primary beam, so whatever the size of your beam is on the sky, upwards to the full size of the survey. And so you can see for something with 15-meter dishes, and this is a function of redshift here, because, of course, your angular scales are going to convert to different physical scales as a function of redshift. And these are the BAO. You see that, you know, an interferometer isn't really seeing much of the BAO scales until redshift of about one here with the SKA. If you were designing the SKA to do intensity mapping in an interferometer mode, you'd use much smaller dishes, so probably something like 5 meters or something, and you'd very closely pack them together. So your shortest baseline is extremely short. As it is, the shortest baseline you can even possibly have is 15 meters, which just isn't short enough. So we have to rely on the single dish mode, this autocorrelation mode, which is this red band. And you can see you can at least resolve the angular CMB up to about redshift 1, the angular BAO up to a redshift about 1. And then beyond that, you're kind of relying on the radial BAO. So there's this trade-off, and the point here is that the SK isn't an ideal experiment for doing intensity mapping. But it has most of its funding, it's being constructed, and so we should try and use it at least. Okay, so I should try and wrap up shortly, because we're running out of time, or we have run out of time. So, this is essentially just what I've said with a few kind of extra bits. There are big systematic problems induced by using an autocorrelation mode. You have things like correlated noise that you don't get in interferometric observations. That's a big issue for CMB experiments. There are various strategies you can use to try and remove that, things like scanning across the sky very quickly or designing your receivers to be extremely stable. Again, that's more difficult with the SKA because of other constraints. But there are some advantages. You don't have any missing baselines, for example. You see all of the Fourier modes from the scale of the beam upwards, essentially. And in our forecast, at least, it turns out to be the much better option for doing things like dark energy. And indeed, it's the only way of using the SKA for these ultra-large scales. Okay, so I'll just whiz through this a bit just to show you some actual forecasts on ultra-large scales. These are the constraints on FNL as a function of maximum redshift of some Fuddishall SKA survey. And you can see you're heading down to about the sigma FNL of about one level. And then I was just going to briefly give you a tour of some of the systematic issues. So one is foreground contamination. It turns out that current foreground subtraction methods, especially these blind methods, you just do something like subtract a set of polynomials in frequency space from your data, do pretty well. So this is the number of polynomial terms that you subtract. Obviously, 8 is the most. So that after only a few terms, you're recovering your signal to about the 10 to the minus 3 level, which is great on these higher k, smaller scales. But on larger scales, you see it rapidly gets worse. So the larger scales are smoother varying functions of frequency, and so they get tangled up with the foreground modes, and they also get mistakenly subtracted.
So what do you do about that? That's what you're interested in.
Yeah, so this is still an open question. The foreground issue is much more complicated than what I'm presenting here, so there's lots to do, but I think you should be able to use a Gibbs sampling method similar to the one that we use for the CMB. This is the current primary foreground subtraction method for Planck, for both temperature and polarization, I believe. You should be able to use at least very similar techniques to model these large scales, which will help to break this degeneracy, which will help reduce this residual here. This is something I'm working on right now. It remains to be demonstrated, but I'm pretty confident it should work, at least in relatively idealized cases. When we start layering on more complicated effects, it's going to get more difficult. But, you know, we have to see. Another issue is polarization leakage. This is a big one. So if we're subtracting smooth polynomials in frequency space, this is all based on the assumption that the foreground spectra are very smooth. So synchrotron should have something like a power law spectrum, for example, frequency to some power. That needn't be the case in polarization due to Faraday rotation in the galactic plane. You get some oscillations, essentially, in your frequency spectrum. They're also a function of angle. And that's more difficult to subtract using these blind methods. So that's all I'm showing here. And depending on how much polarization leaks into your detector, that could be a very large issue. Possibly an even bigger issue than just the straightforward temperature foregrounds. So again, that's kind of an open problem. As I mentioned earlier, this autocorrelation issue, this is what a CMB map looks like. These are all simulations, by the way. A CMB map looks like that hasn't been destriped, so the effects of this correlated noise haven't been taken out. And you see it looks horrific. So you need to filter in some way or choose your scanning strategy so that it lets you solve for these correlated modes and kind of subtract them out. And then you can get your nice, clean, pretty WMAP map or whatever. There are various reasons why this is difficult, and it pretty much all comes down to things like calibration. And there's also another issue that you don't get quite so much with interferometers, which is ground pickup. So this is things leak from the surrounding environment into your beam. Things like the surrounding landscape, and that gets added up into your autocorrelation maps as well. Just to give you a picture of what that actually looks like, this is what we'll assume is a clean picture of the sky in synchrotron. And this is a picture at a slightly higher frequency of what should be the same emission without this ground contamination being subtracted. You see, you get all these nasty artifacts here. Again, this is a function of the way you scan. So you need to do things like shielding your telescope from the ground. This is very difficult when you have an instrument with hundreds of dishes. It's going to cost a lot of money to construct all of that shielding. Or you have to have a very good model of the ground and subtract it. Again, it's an open problem. We are doing some test surveys using the Cat7 dishes. This is very early stages for this. There are, of course, only 7 dishes. These have significantly inferior performance to the SKA, but we're at least using this data to try and get a handle on what some of these autocorrelation systematics are. So watch this space for that. And then I'll cut to the summary. So sorry for going over a bit, and thanks for your attention.
Scale stuff, mm-hmm. Is that mostly galactic contamination, or is that mostly coming from extragalactic
sources? So we believe it's mostly galactic, because you see the galactic stuff, it's really there on these very large angular scales. You know, we're in the galaxy, so I mean it's exactly the same as for the CMB, but also in frequency, because it has a very different frequency dependence to the primary H1 signal. That's both a good and bad thing on the smaller scales. It means because the H1 signal is fluctuating very rapidly and these things are smooth, it means they're easier to subtract. But because these things are so smooth in frequency, that means they're slightly degenerate with this, with the longer wavelength H1 cosmological modes. So yeah, that's really the problem.
Could you use our understanding of foregrounds in the CMB to sort of extrapolate and
It certainly should help, but most of the best constraints on foregrounds like synchrotron already come from low frequencies in a similar regime to this. So most of the many CMB analyses rely on things like the 408 megahertz Haslam map to subtract the synchrotron emission. So I mean, it will help. You're adding more data. That's always helpful. Sort of. But probably the converse is true. This will be much more helpful to CMB experiments, because we'll have really exquisite maps of the synchrotron emission, whether we want them or not.
I assume that you can't do the single dish mode and the interferometry at the same time for technical reasons, namely that there's some correlator issue. You can't just store all the data. So you have to do this in electronics,
and
that limits how you do it. Is that the reason why?
So that's
you
not
kind
that's
of
not
present it as an either or.
Yeah. So it's not really the data rate that's a problem. So I mean, the SK is already designed to operate in an interferometric mode, mm-hmm. Right? So it's already. I mean, there's a really colossal computing budget designed to store all of the cross correlation data. And what they were going to do was just throw away the autocorrelation data, maybe use it for some basic calibration, and then just throw it away. Now we've got them to change the design so they keep the autocorrelation data. And of course, the autocorrelation is just something like n extra streams, where n is the number of dishes. For interferometry, at least you have n something like n squared. So it's really trivial in terms of the data rate.
So they can do them
at the same time. You can do them at the same time. The issue is probably more to do with things like pointing stability. So for an autocorrelation survey, for an interferometer, if you're trying to measure individual sources, you probably want to track that source with all of the dishes and get a really stable sort of mutual pointing on that source. You don't really want to do that in autocorrelation mode because of this correlated noise. What you really want to do is scan or drift scan. And so this is another difficult trade-off. You end up kind of sacrificing stability in one mode for stability in another mode. So, I mean, it is possible, but I think it would probably be very difficult.
Okay.